He's a world-renowned zombie scholar, professor of zombies and popular media, and co-author of the book Zombie Mania, one of the first exhaustive guides to zombie cinema. He's Dr. Arnold T. Blumberg, the Doctor of the Dead.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Well, hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 105 of the Doctor of the Dead podcast. And we're going to jump right back in with something we've been doing for the last couple episodes. It is coming up on Halloween season. Well, it already is as far as we're concerned.
It really is Halloween season, and I wish more stores would accept the fact that Halloween season starts sooner.
Mm-hmm. At least Labor Day, if not September 1st.
At a bare minimum.
And we've been doing the rounds, and we've told you about some of our stuff. If you follow at ATB Publishing on Instagram, for instance, you will see a lot of our most recent up-to-date pictures of all of our adventures. I also recently posted a picture from our latest jaunt, which we'll talk about, but I also feel we're heading into like phase two of the shopping, which is it's time to figure out how many tombstones we have before we buy any more of them. So we're doing a survey now, and yesterday we did another little round of stores, starting with Halloween City, the Halloween outgrowth of Party City.
It was a little bittersweet for us because the Halloween City that we went to was set up inside the skeletal remains of my childhood Toys R Us. So it was a little sobering because they still have all the Toys R Us lore and all the signs are still up for the sections. They just didn't take them down.
All the R's are still up when you walk in. The first thing I remember saying was, since Halloween City is setting up inside a defunct store and they're really just setting up displays and then creating some walls and curtains to give them some room to stage, you can really see from one end of the place to the other. And it just struck me how small it really looked once everything is out of there. When you're in Toys R Us and it was all built up to the ceiling and everything was filled, it just felt like you never knew. You could walk down another corner, another aisle, and there'd be all this great stuff. And it just seemed really small.
Well, also, I mean, you're not child size either.
That's true,
too. So there's a difference there. But I agree. I mean, without the shelving in there, it feels a lot smaller. And I think they weren't quite done setting up. Yeah, this is what I don't understand. Either you open or you don't. But Spirit does this as well, where they'll open the store. But I remember when we went to the Spirit in York. While we were there, there was one aisle where an employee had just dumped out boxes and boxes of costumes and was just filling pegs on the shelves that hadn't been filled yet. So I don't quite understand that.
Yeah, I don't get it either. I think there's this sense of they got to get this thing rolling and make sure as many people as possible get a chance to get in there and spend money with them. But if you don't have it all ready to go yet, why are you open?
Well, if you walk in and there's only a handful of things on the shelf, what are the odds you're actually going to come back?
And in the case of Halloween City, I always like seeing what some of the other seasonal Halloween brands are doing. Spirit really seems, though, to have cornered the market in many ways. And I would say in terms of quality, too, and we buy a lot of stuff from Spirit, but I still also find it interesting that no matter what other people out there, people I have nothing in common with, who have issues about Halloween, it's still no denying that this is a multi-million dollar industry every year with an extraordinary amount of money being spent. And yet, it still amazes me that for all the things we occasionally see and think, oh, that's really well done, so much of this stuff is still so poorly made. Like the tombstones are still just gray painted styrofoam that looks like it's falling apart.
That's meant to go outside in the rain, in autumnal weather.
Yeah. And then like just lots of either masks or set pieces or little statues or things. And they're all hand painted and painted poorly. Like they were just slapdash. And it's like, if this is really such a big industry and we all love Halloween so much, why are we all settling for stuff that's just so bad looking? And that seems to be across the board.
It really, like, I can understand cheaper looking and price tagging wigs and things like that, where there are markets for really high-end stuff. When we were at Potterverse, one of the vendors, I was talking to her, she came in costume and she just had this huge sort of very ornate curled pink wig and it looked like real hair and it was absolutely gorgeous. And like, that's the kind of thing where there's a market for that and for people who use things like that. And then there are the people who are like, I just want to turn my hair green, so I'll just spray it with chalk paint or the people who are happy to buy the like plastic streamer wig that you just pull on because you just need to turn your hair purple for the day. So I can understand there being like a range of quality for items like that, but a lot of the stuff we see, I don't understand why it exists because it looks so bad. I can't imagine anyone buying it.
And I mean, some of it is subjective. Some of it is like your own personal aesthetics about what Halloween means to you and what you like. So for instance, there's a lot of Halloween that I love where it's treated seriously. You want to see something that looks, you know, frightening and horrific and put the zombie out or the Michael Myers mask and it should all look real, quote unquote, you know, like that. But I also do like goofy Halloween stuff or fun Halloween stuff, but I can be very specific about what I like and don't like about that. A certain kind of goofy pumpkin face or a certain kind of cute skeleton. Sometimes there are versions of that that I don't respond to at all. And sometimes I think, oh, that's just the right blend of goofy and fun with the horror and I can do it. But the point is, when it comes to that, you have a wide range of choices and there are people with a lot of different aesthetics for what works. That part's fine.
You're talking about design choices.
Yes. That,
like some people like different types of design, which makes sense because especially people with small kids. And we have on more than one occasion walking through a Halloween store encountered a kid who was just totally freaked out by something in a display of I want to leave. I don't like that. It happened yesterday at Target. There was a big inflatable light up phantom looking thing, which I thought looked kind of cute, but the kid's like, Mom, no, Mom, I'm scared, Mom. So,
and it goes in the other direction too, as you found
that's
out.
That's true. I saw a mom and her daughter walking through Halloween City, and the daughter was like pretty excited and checking out all the stuff. And then they walk into an aisle that's clown themed, and the daughter like puts her hand on a package, is like, Mom, look. And she turns to her and's like, You know, Mommy doesn't like clowns, and like pulled her out of the aisle. And I was like, This is amazing. But I also think it's sort of like, yeah, okay, you want something that's just sort of cute and a little ghosty and you want orange and black themed things.
Yeah.
That's fine. But we saw some of the most awful stuff when we were around. Like, they had the little zombie garden gnomes.
Those look terrible.
But they weren't actually, like, the size of actual garden gnomes. They were like, what if a garden gnome had a garden gnome for their garden? That's the size. And it looked like what they did is just put a stencil over the whole thing and then throw different colors of paints at the different stencil holes. Mm-hmm. It was like, this is not something that someone will buy ever.
No, it's garbage. And a lot of the vacuform plastic stuff never works for me.
Yeah.
It's like, if I want a sign, I want the sign to look like an actual sign, but I don't need the vacuform. But again, some of this, like, some people are happy with that and that's fine. But there's our rant on quality of Halloween merchandise.
Well, the other half of the rant, too, is that there are so many stores. I'm looking at you, Target, right now, because Target has an amazing design aesthetic when it comes to Halloween.
Particularly this year.
I love some of the stuff they're doing. Each year they come up with kind of a different motif and a different style, and then they repeat that on all of their things.
Yeah,
the napkins, the housewares, the towels.
They have a slightly asymmetrical funny skeleton now that's one of the ones that's carrying through, which is cute.
Yeah, it's nice, except that Target started putting things out in the dollar spot in the front a month ago, but not all of the stuff, just some of the stuff. And every time they do, I think everybody panics and is like, this is the only thing Target's going to have. And whatever they put out is decimated in a day. And then I walked to the back of the store at the Target by my work at the end of the week. I went on Friday and they only had out a handful of kids' costumes and like a few pumpkins, but mostly it was just big boxes that they hadn't unpacked yet. And we went to a different Target yesterday and it was to a certain extent about the same thing. There was an employee out who was like trying to stock the shelf with all of the little birds.
He was taking it very seriously too. He was really setting that up beautifully.
Either that or he really just wanted that to be the only thing he did that day.
So, and take his time with
take it. Take his time with it, which
yeah,
is fine. It's a very
fine.
Happy place to be stocking the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Even walking through, we could tell they still hadn't put everything out yet.
Yeah.
And it's like, at this point, it starts to like offend me just a little bit. Because I know as soon as it hits November 1st, like Halloween's over, it's November 1st, all the Christmas stuff is going to be out. And that's 2 months before Christmas. So for some of us, this is Christmas. Give us this at least a little bit sooner. Because I just kind of want to revel in the season a little.
We hit Halloween City. It was underwhelming as far as like going to a spirit is concerned.
Definitely.
Very costume heavy. And also, they didn't have a lot of adult stuff yet, but they might. You know, it's hard to say. One thing that struck me that I was, and you said you did see a variation of it at Spirit that really struck me as odd, is I have a lot of opinions that we will not go into right now about the level of offensiveness or the lines that should be drawn as far as sensitivity when it comes to Halloween costuming. There are a lot of opinions and a lot of gray areas. But one thing that really struck me going through Halloween City was there was a section for witch doctors and voodoo zombies. And there was like a voodoo Hungan high priest mask that looked like it had traveled through time from the 1930s from some sort of like vaudeville blackface performance. I was stunned at the absolute offensiveness and racial insensitivity of that stuff. There's no excusing that. This is not a gray area. That is utter cultural appropriation, and actually with no particular monstrous design, just the demonizing of a human being. And I could not believe it. And there it was sitting next to vampires and werewolves. If this is another indication of where we are in 2018, that is something that I don't want to see happening for Halloween. It was utterly wrong.
And I know they had a whole witch doctor themed section at Spirit, but we didn't really look at it. I'm sure we'll be back in Spirit and we'll have to take a closer look. There's the sort of cultural appropriation corner in every Spirit that we usually just don't walk through, where they have the Native American headdresses and things that we're like, we're just not even going to bother walking through this section because we have no interest in any of that. But I feel like maybe we should walk through it this time and go back to a Spirit and just see
what's
exactly
there.
What they're appropriating this year.
In addition to Halloween City, so the two, you already mentioned Target. I don't know if there was much else to say about Target. There's some cool stuff there, but we'll
too
see
much
what
glitter.
Happens.
Just too much glitter everywhere.
We're both very adamant about the being against the glitterification of Halloween.
For two reasons. One is that Halloween is not a sparkly holiday.
I was going to say, Halloween does not sparkle.
It does not. So, you know, put it away, Twilight. We're not in that mode. But also, I just have a pathological aversion to glitter. I hate it. There's something about it that makes me very uncomfortable. It's like I can handle all kinds of things, gore and bugs and blood and viscera, but I can't handle glitter. Now you know, listening audience.
It'd be like a zombie movie where every time people punch or shoot a zombie, they burst out glitter instead of blood.
I would pee my pants.
Glitter zombies. So that was our trip. Oh, yeah. And the last place we checked as far as Halloween stuff is Home Depot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. We've noticed in the last couple of years how much Home Depot and Lowe's, I guess, too, have really ramped up their Halloween offerings. And in particular, since they are a place that's geared more toward the idea of home decoration and improvement, it seems like they focus a lot more on outdoor materials. So if you're looking for the all-in-one stop and don't want to go to a Spirit for all your fog juice and fog hose needs, you can go to Home Depot. But they now also have some very impressive life-size animatronic figures, including a werewolf that looked very much like the American Werewolf in London full werewolf.
And it's like an entire creature. Like, it's not just the head that you mount somewhere. It has like the full like arched back and the legs.
We took a picture of that, right?
I took a picture of you getting cuddly with the werewolf face, but I don't know if I took a picture of the whole body that really like gives you a look at it. I'm sure if you went to the Home Depot website, they probably feature it because it was part of a display where they were saying there's even more animatronics that they sell that they didn't have in store. And they had this whole display where you could see all the different options because it's not just for Halloween. They sell them for all kinds of different holidays and events.
Werewolves can be all year round. You can just put it out for Arbor Day and, you know, just have it out there. Flag Day. Be a werewolf on your lawn.
Perfect.
Failure, though, on the talking pumpkin figure who, when I hit the button, beckoned me to come closer, which I did, and then come closer, which I did again, and then stop talking. It's like he just couldn't handle the fact that I was
such
willing.
Such a tease.
Yeah. I was just, it's like, come on, bring it. But nope, he just shut down completely.
Also at Home Depot, we saw our first scripture card of the season that someone had left in amongst the Halloween decorations, just in case you want to turn away from evil and back to the light. So I dropped it into a witch's cauldron, and we called it a day.
Well, we've been talking for quite a while about the fact that my new book that covers 50 years of Night of the Living Dead's legacy and almost 100 years of zombie cinema is out now, Journey of the Living Dead. I'm doing everything I can, and so is Natalie, to get the word out about the book and to focus on it as we roll ever closer to the actual 50th anniversary date, which is October 1st, 2018. And I'm just now starting to do some appearances elsewhere and interviews in support of the book and in support of this extraordinary anniversary date. And it's also worth noting that although the date's not the same, we're also in this year celebrating the 40th anniversary of Dawn of the Dead. So it's a lot of zombie history being celebrated in 2018. And I recently did an interview over at kpbs.org, and Beth Accomando does the Cinema Junkie podcast there. And it feels like we've almost settled into a nearly annual tradition of reconnecting. Beth and I talk about different things happening in zombies. In the past, we've done episodes of her show where we've talked about the trend in sentient zombies from Warm Bodies and that kind of thing. And this was a wonderful conversation. I had sent her a review copy of Journey and was so gratified that she enjoyed it so much. And we spent the episode talking about how zombies can be used, as I do, to teach media literacy and critical thinking in the college environment. And she even turned it back on me and asked me some of the questions we had included in the book to see what I thought about some of these things. So if you go to kpbs.org or any of our social media, you will find links to that particular interview and a link directly to the book as well. And then in just a couple weeks, on September 28th to the 30th, Natalie and I will be at the Monster Mania Convention in Hunt Valley, Maryland. It'll be our first time at a Monster Mania. We'll have a table set up, and I will have copies of Journey of the Living Dead there, and I'll be signing those for anyone that's interested. And we'll also have an interesting variety of new items that are very specifically zombie-themed that we really hope horror fans will take to, because we've put a lot of love into the thought behind some of these designs. And if you've been following us for a while, you know we've been doing some buttons and pins and magnets and things using designs I've created in homage to zombie movies. So we have a few new things we'll be debuting at Monster Mania.
We also have my first design project, which is a whole bunch of pumpkin emoji buttons.
Yeah.
Which I had a lot of fun doing. So those will be making their debut as well. A perhaps slightly minor debut for the pumpkin buttons as opposed to the book.
I think they're an equal debut. It's a pumpkin button for nearly every mood. Depending on how you feel when you go by the table, you can find the pumpkin that suits you.
That's right.
Before we launch into our movies for this episode, there was something else that you brought up earlier this week that you wanted to talk about. So you have the floor.
Yeah, it's sort of a rabbit hole news hunt that I went on accidentally. So bear with me, dear listeners. We'll start at the beginning and then I'll take you to where my question is. But I had seen a trailer link for The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, which I think looks amazing. I mean, the trailer looks amazing. I haven't read the comics, so I'm a little torn because I have my own sort of formative years watching Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which has a decidedly different tone to it. But I'm excited to see what this is and how they work with it. In watching that, I had the little spark of a question, which is, how old exactly is Kiernan Shipka, who's going to be playing Sabrina? Because I have a bit of a problem when they cast much older actors or actresses to play 15, 16-year-old characters.
Which used to be a pretty standard Hollywood approach.
Yeah. And I think it's just because she's been on television for so many years, starting as a child, but she's only 18. She's playing a 16-year-old. So in my head, I was like, okay, that makes sense. You've got a relative teenager playing a teenager. But then while I'm on her page, I see another movie title that's a horror movie called The Silence, which I've heard nothing about. So, of course, I click through and see it's got other big stars in it, including Stanley Tucci, who I love. And I thought, huh, I wonder what this is. So I start reading about the movie The Silence, which it looks like got their distribution deal and is supposed to be released in theaters the first week of December. And it's a movie adaptation of a novel by a German author. And I'm sorry if I pronounced the name incorrectly, but his name is Tim Leben, L-E-B-B-O-N. And he wrote this novel. It was published in 2015. As I'm reading the description of the movie and the description of the novel, I start thinking, this sounds so familiar. So The Silence, the novel, and the movie, ostensibly, focus on an exploratory crew that opened up this cave that had never been opened. Out from this cave come pouring these creatures that had never been unleashed on the outer world. And they're vicious and brutal, and they hunt you down based on sound. So the main character in the novel is a deaf girl who is watching this happen in Europe, and she is over in the US thinking, well, how long till it gets to me? It apparently also involves the subplot of a woman who is pregnant. If any of this starts to sound familiar to you, it might be because you've seen the movie A Quiet Place, which we saw earlier this year and enjoyed. It's difficult for me to figure out, did two people in a parallel way have similar ideas and start writing stories, or did they just get an adaptation of his novel to market before he could make a movie of it? The internet seems to have sort of mixed feelings. I think a lot of people actually aren't that familiar with the novel. Or the movie adaptation, because I had heard nothing about it. I found a blog post on the author's website where people were pointing it out to him last fall, where, oh, we saw a trailer for a movie. We thought it was the movie adaptation of The Silence, but it's called A Quiet Place. Is this your book? And he says, no. He says, we are aware of it, and we're looking into it, and there's a lot of similarities. And then later on down the page, she says, oh, well, my movie is going to be very good, and there's a lot of differences, and, you know, it's not the same, but it reads like someone who's had his lawyers look into it, and they've said, well, there's really nothing we can do. So I intend to buy a copy of The Silence and read it, because it sounds like an interesting story, and I'd like to read it before the movie comes out later this year. But I am very curious if there's anybody else who's listening who has read The Silence and who read it before they saw A Quiet Place and felt that same feeling. Because when I read the description, it sounds identical, except that they got there first.
Based on some of the comments and evidence you were uncovering while you were doing your web searches, it really started to feel to me like the standard Hollywood story of somebody saw a draft of a script at some point for The Silence adaptation. Somehow it got into the hands of at least one of the people working on A Quiet Place, and then they just ran with it, which happens so often, but is done in such a way where they're legally protected from being, you know, sued for anything.
It's sort of if you just steal a premise, but not the exact plot.
It's a matter of points of similarity, among other things.
And I will add, neither story is certainly the first time we've ever encountered creatures that hunt by sound or something being unleashed, whether it's by invasion from another planet or whether it's by opening up a cave that no one's been in before. I mean, there are certainly stories like that.
You mentioned Descent.
Yeah, Descent, you know, it's like that these creatures in that movie ostensibly have been living underground on Earth for who knows how long and hunting by sound. It's just we've never been in the places where they are. And, you know, that's part of the aspect of that horror that makes it so horrifying is that they're already there. They're right here. There's no invasion. They're among us. It's a very creepy idea. And I can find the sort of kernel of, I don't know, reality in that horror that I like. But I don't know. It's not exactly the world's most original premise for a creature, but the fact that there are so many similarities in the story and that it's the central figure being a deaf girl and trying to protect her family, and it feels very, I don't know, it feels very familiar, I guess.
Thank you.
Well, for this episode, we have three films that we watched in the last week or so, and they're an interesting mix, two of which seem very well connected with one another, and the third may be a bit of an outlier, but still.
I'd make the argument that they all follow the same thematic points.
Okay. But first up is one that was actually recommended to us by a listener on Twitter, Matthew Dawkins. He suggested that we check out, if we hadn't already, Ravenous, which is Les Affamés, which is a French-Canadian film from 2017. It has generally gotten very good reviews. You had already put it in your Netflix queue as a thing to watch. So we jumped right in and we watched Ravenous, which, short version, is one of many films in which an unexplained infection of some sort has rendered just about everyone into a murderous, crazed, zombie-like being. It does seem like there's a bit of murkiness about the actual undead nature. It seems like they are undead. It seems like you have to hack them up or get them in the head in order to stop them. But I do feel like it's a bit opaque about whether that's exactly the case or if they're more like 28 Days Later infected.
It is clear that they are flesh eaters, though.
Yes, we do know that.
So they are flesh eaters, and not just in a to infect people way, but there's a comment at one point in the movie where one of the characters is saying they're more around suddenly than there used to be, and someone else says they're running out of food, that they're looking to feed.
And we follow a group of, pretty much your typical group, slowly assembles during the first hour or so of the movie. Young and old, couples and individuals, people from rural community, people from the city. It's all of the various familiar elements as far as character. And they slowly assemble and are traveling through the Quebec countryside, which is one thing that will be common through all these movies, by the way, strangely enough, even the third one, is how beautiful they all are. All three movies we're talking about today, at multiple times throughout watching all three of them, I was constantly saying things like what a beautiful or gorgeous shot it was. They are all incredibly well-shot movies.
One of the things I really liked about the scenery in Ravenous is there were a few scenes where they're walking through fields, and it's the kind of thing, there was one, it was almost like fern-like field, it was like this leafy field, and you know, you see a creature and she kind of drops down on her back and disappears into these ferns, and it's just such a cool shot. To watch people disappear into nature is just something that I've always found fascinating, because you know, we tend to be the animal that doesn't blend very well. Like, a lot of other animals are built to camouflage, but we have to like go to the store and buy it and put it on in order to blend.
And it does seem that one of the overriding themes of this movie that is very prominent is from everything to the incredible misfire of The Happening to classic zombie movies like Let Sleeping Corpses Lie. There's an ecological bent to this on one level where
it's like... You mentioned Grapes of Death at one point while we were watching.
Another French movie that also has sort of a melancholic, languorous approach to storytelling, very similar in certain respects. And they all have this idea of nature trying to correct itself against the scourge that is man. The zombie behavior in this was one of the things that we found the most compelling and ultimately the most frustrating. I'm trying to like leave some of the negative to the end, but the zombie behavior was extraordinary because as you started to see them, they had this bizarre tendency to just stand, often with their head tilted, sometimes not, but just stand absolutely still, as if they are hearing some internal voice or something larger than themselves. And there is the hint that perhaps there's a sense of collective consciousness, or at the very least, a sense of cooperation, where one of the things that comes up is some very skin-crawling, chilling imagery where we discover that the zombies, while not attacking people, are busy building what look like huge towering monuments composed of ordinary objects, a tower of chairs, a tower of teddy bears and toys, and then will just stand around individually and look at it or not look at it.
Just kind of be near it.
Yeah.
And the thing that I found most creepy about that was the fact that the second time you see one of these, you realize that the stacks of things are curated. It's not just they're grabbing anything they can because they want to make a big pile of something. That stack of chairs, it was just chairs.
Mm-hmm.
And there were also chairs scattered around it as if at some point they were sitting in the chairs and just looking at the chairs from the chair, which when you're trying to kind of, at least for the survivors in the movie, trying to cope with the idea that these are not human beings anymore, it makes them a little bit more human again.
And it also struck me as the kind of theme that crops up in so many other films, including even big blockbusters like Will Smith's I Am Legend and Matheson's original book. This idea that perhaps, although we don't understand what it is, there is a culture or a thought process going on that makes them their own civilization or their own community in a way that we don't understand. And that stillness is one of the creepiest things about them. And then, of course, the other aspect of it, which I think you said was one of the reasons that really enticed you to watch the movie, and because you see it in the trailer, is when they get close to them in the field at one point, one of the old men zombies is just standing there for a minute and then lets out this unholy animal-like shriek that instantly reminded me of Donald Sutherland at the end of the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which also immediately reminds me of that idea of the collective consciousness of some alien thing there that's speaking to one another.
And that they're communicating with each other.
I know you wanted to really try to avoid a lot of spoilers, too.
I would like to, especially because this is a very new movie, and because it's...
Well, we just told one of the biggest creepy things about the movie, though. But
that's also in some of the trailer
materials.
It's in the trailers,
yeah.
And this is how I'd phrase it. Most of the professional reviews of the movie, like in newspapers and magazines that I've found, use as images in the review that tower of chairs.
Okay.
So I think that one's out there. It's not, you know, so much of a spoiler. I think I would like to not spoil the plot, except to say that this does follow a lot of traditional beats.
Here's where we get to the main issue, though, with Ravenous. It is being lauded for the most part in critiques as being a lot of them are saying it's a breath of fresh air for the zombie genre, breathes new life into the zombie genre. I saw no evidence of that, except for the beautiful camera work, some really stunning direction. There's some great just camera moves in this movie. Everyone in it performs very well. The cast across the board is excellent, and some of those elements of the zombie behavior are truly disturbing and make you unsettled. But ultimately, the story and the characters in that story are a collection of every predictable trope we've ever seen in zombie and post-apocalyptic survival storytelling, and it all basically amounts to nothing.
And I think part of the reason that we're a little conflicted here is we've talked about the fact that there's nothing inherently wrong with these tropes, that they work in many films that we've seen. We've seen a lot of movies about survivors coming together, trying to make it from point A to point B. There are unexpected twists along the way. There's usually a big climactic confrontation with some kind of horde, whether that's human or zombie. And the reason that they're tropes is because they work. I mean, these beats do work. The other part of it, too, is, as you've said, this is a beautiful movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's very well made. The writing is fantastic. Some of the dialogue is so pithy. And there's these back and forth conversations where people are finding such sort of enjoyably almost perverse humor in the situation that they're in. That's part of what makes the characters feel very real, that they are real people who all live in this town for the most part. And even the outsiders have been in this long enough that they've been stripped down to a point where they can converse with each other very naturally. And in addition to that, it's just funny as hell at some points. So after we watched the movie, I think both of us felt like we didn't regret watching it. And I think we'd probably tell people you should watch it, or we'd, you know, recommend it. But it was not, I think, what we had hoped it would be. And to a certain extent, I think perhaps it didn't come out as the director either maybe hoped it did or thinks it did, because we read an interview with the director that was sort of eye-opening into the process and into his motivations.
I was impressed with the fact that he seemed to know a lot of his history. He name checks Romero and Argento and Bava, and he even mentions Antonioni, and then he talked about John Carpenter's The Fog, and there's this fog sequence in the movie that's very beautifully done, and he just seemed to have a real reverence for all of the things in the genre, and he also laid out all of his meanings. You even found an explanation for a post-credit sequence, which, by the way, watch all the way to the end of the movie, there's a post-credit sequence, and yet, looking back at the film, he didn't really very effectively accomplish communicating the themes that he believed he was including in the film. It is a deeply flawed movie that, did we mention already the part about how we paused it?
No.
Okay.
We paused the movie at a certain point to do like a drink and snack break, and we paused it. I looked up at the TV and I was like, oh my god. And I realized that we'd only been watching the movie for 45 minutes, but I thought we were in the last act and there was still an hour of movie left.
The pacing was terrible, and not in a way that makes it a quote unquote slow burn or a, like I said, languorous like Grapes of Death, which is also not a great movie.
It's not really
classic 70s.
It's just
French
so
movie.
Quintessentially French in that everyone's going to be turned into zombies because of wine.
But it takes its time, and that can be a good thing. Or in this case, it just feels like it takes its time because it really doesn't have enough story to support a feature length. And then by the time we got toward the end, I was just losing respect for it in other ways. There's one scene where someone sustains an injury that is so extraordinary, so incredibly damaging to a body part, and then just sits there throughout several subsequent scenes with certainly no verbalizing of pain, but with no indication that this character is experiencing any sensation at all, as if, perhaps, it's merely an actor with a prosthetic stuck on, because that's what it is. But it was so ridiculously unrealistic in the wake of this extraordinary physical disfigurement that I'm like, what is this even doing at this point?
And it's a different kind of situation where you watch a movie, somebody sustains like a minor zombie bite to the arm or something where it's like just enough where a tooth punctures the skin and you think, well, I'm done for. And then they get kind of melancholy and contemplative and have a conversation with someone while they wait to turn. That's the kind of situation where you can expect that scene to come after the injury. But this was it's a pretty injurious injury.
Ultimately, Ravenous is a beautiful piece of work. And I think you're right. We would still suggest people check it out. But I think we would warn them that it's probably going to disappoint. If I have any credibility as zombie expert at all, I would definitely put out in the world that this movie is not the breath of fresh air or breathing new life into the genre. It is, in fact, a replay of every single predictable plot turn, character, and trope that you've ever seen, and it's only given a bit of energy by the fact that it looks beautiful, that it's set perhaps in a different area than you're used to seeing, and that it adds a few interesting creepy touches that then, I'll just tell you flat out, lead to pretty much nothing, and will leave you feeling disappointed and frustrated. But I'm still going to say, see it, you might see something different in it than we did. But the interesting thing is, while watching this, you then said, we should also watch The Crazies. We're not talking about George Romero's The Crazies, which I saw only once, I think, in all these years. But the 2010 remake, which strangely enough, I've never seen, and which came out in 2010, the same year that The Walking Dead TV show debuted. So it came out at a particularly odd time during the resurgence of the zombies' popularity post 28 Days Later, Resident Evil, Dawn of the Dead remake, The Walking Dead comic, and then right before The Walking Dead TV show was going to ramp things up to a whole new level. And in comes The Crazies remake.
Would you mind taking a look at Bill?
Sure, what's wrong?
I don't know. He's just not right.
She worries too much. I'm fine.
You got any plans this weekend?
She worries too much. I'm fine.
Hey, Ben. Ben.
What's Dad doing? He has a knife.
Done! And there are a lot of similarities in the basic premise and even the basic setting of a rural community dealing with this explosion of violence and transformation of their family and friends. And I have to say, I think The Crazies remake is one of the most enjoyable film watching experiences in terms of zombie or apocalyptic films I have had in years. This is a movie that almost across the board subverts every expectation, treats its characters, and this is something really unusual in the horror genre. The characters are smart, they make the right decisions for the most part, they do things they should do that don't make you scream, "What are you doing?" And the story plays out around intelligent characters that are capable at their jobs and that are facing a really well-structured apocalypse. It also has some of the tensest and most stressful, in a good way, action and horror sequences I've seen in years. And it is stunning to me that more people don't talk about the 2010 Crazies as an excellent example of zombie storytelling.
I think that it fell victim to, in a certain respect, the same thing that the Dawn of the Dead remake fell victim to, which was if they had just called it something else and people didn't have that memory or that expectation or wanting, if I don't know if maybe people wanted just a shot for shot remake of the original, but with fresher cast. And that's not what it is. And I think that that's why it didn't really get a fair chance. But it's a great movie. I mean, I absolutely love the pathology of it. I love the way that they've set it up, the way that they show you eventually sort of the characters figuring out not just what this is, but why it's happening, how it was spreading, how you have to stop it. It's sort of like they figure it all out.
That's the thing that I find one of the most endearing things about the main characters. It also in many ways feels like a throwback to 50s sci-fi movies because it all starts with like the rural sheriff and deputy. You know, there's a story that's bigger than them that's going on. And yet this is a real tribute to middle America and the sheriff and deputy trope in that in the first act of the film, they as very effective investigators figure out the entire logic of what's going on, where it's coming from, what must be happening, and have it all figured out. And then the movie moves on and expands into sort of a road trip pursuit because they've already solved the story that most other movies would wait until the final act to tell us, but they're smart and they got it. And I was very impressed. And I thought, these are characters I can really root for because they're not stupid and they're not making dumb decisions.
One of the things I always tell people when I talk about The Crazies and try to get them to watch it if they haven't is if you at all like Dean Koontz novels, then you will like The Crazies. Dean Koontz sort of has a real fixation on strange things happening in small towns, whether that's supernatural or occasionally sort of Lovecraftian or in many cases part of like a government conspiracy. That's sort of his jam. That's what he does. So one of the Dean Koontz novels that it sort of reminds me of that they did make a movie adaptation of as well, which is not that good, is Phantoms. So I don't know if you've ever seen the movie version of Phantoms. It actually will feel like it is hitting some of the same beats.
But Affleck was the bomb in Phantoms.
Word, bitch. Phantom's like a motherfucker. What's up now?
But the novel Phantoms is much more otherworldly, Lovecraftian, not so much government conspiracy. And the other one I'd recommend in terms of books, anyway, sort of, I recommend in terms of concept, but there are parts of it that make me uncomfortable to read, is the book Night Chills, which is a government test, essentially, sort of quasi-government, quasi-private industry test of a combination of chemical sort of intoxication combined with subliminal messaging that you could program people and then have them be able to be activated via keyword to do what you ask them to do. And they decide, we'll just test it out on some small town in the mountains where no one will know what's happening. And then the end, we'll just, you know, blitz the whole thing. And of course, their plan does not go according to plan. But the book itself has some sort of uncomfortable moments, especially like violence against women and rape If that makes you uncomfortable, I would say don't read it. But it's that concept of like something strange and beyond their ability to control happening to the people of a small town.
There's also stuff in The Crazies that struck me as interesting given when it came out. You have in Timothy Oliphant as the lead, a really likable character, a competent law enforcement official who's trying to protect everyone, his wife, his town. Got his best friend and deputy. Joe Anderson plays deputy, and Rhoda Mitchell plays plays Judy, his wife, who's also a doctor. So between the two of them, you've got the law side, and you've also got the medical side covered. What fascinated me, particularly as you get toward the end of the movie, and it's the three of them walking along like an empty highway, and there's even a sequence where they roll out the spikes on a road and flip over a car, which is almost identical visually to the opening sequence in the pilot episode of The Walking Dead. And if you think about the fact that this movie follows as its central characters, the local sheriff, his best friend, deputy, and the sheriff's wife, all I could think about through most of the movie was how interesting it would have been if this thing had gone to series, or if The Walking Dead had starred Timothy Oliphant as Rick Grimes. Because there's a lot of similarities in the basic dynamic. And I'm not saying Andrew Lincoln didn't do a great job, and I love John Bernthal as Shane, but I'm also thinking watching this, these people would have been awesome too. And who knows what that version of things would have been. So I like that a lot. The Crazies are also very similar to the creatures in the French-Canadian film Ravenous. They are also a bit murky. I think we're certain they're undead at a certain point. Like, as they visually change physically, I think we're getting the impression that they've crossed over at some point, because then they need to be taken out very definitively.
The impression that I get is that whatever this toxin is that's in their system, eventually it will kill you. But until it does, it's sort of like that rage virus idea, but much more higher functioning. You still maintain your own person and your own sort of predilections, memories, ability to talk and communicate. And I think one of the things about it is that injury will eventually kill you. It's just you're sort of impervious to pain. And so you experience this grave injury, but don't feel it, so you keep going.
One of the things that apparently was, I try not to look at too much behind the scenes stuff when we look at ones we just watched, just get our impressions of it. But Breck Eisner directed Crazies, mentioned that when they designed the makeup for the Crazies, he described the look as hyper alive. So that's actually an interesting thing. It's not that they're undead. It's like you're saying, it's like the ultimate version of like being on PCP or something. They can't feel it anymore. And they're so over energized that they're like a battery burning out. And that might be a way of looking at it. It's excellent. There's a sequence with a pitchfork that became one of the icons of one of the posters that is so jarring and so unsettling. There's the kind of horror in it that we've talked about in the past, where some injuries are like those tiny things, the little realistic injuries that hurt to watch. But I mean in an effective way, in a way that's very much raises the stakes in the film. There are several moments where there's a last minute save that's all too convenient, but I felt the movie earned it every single time just by virtue of how well it was doing. And then in the final act, there are a couple occasions where two of the characters split up in a way that I felt was falling a bit too far back into cliche. But again, it was so minor in comparison to how well the rest of this movie was handled that at that point, it's like, you know, they're both so worn out, I'm just going to give it to them. They split up for a minute. They shouldn't, but okay. And the ending has one of the most stunning images toward the end that I've seen in a movie, which I'm probably going to tip by just putting it right in the picture for the episode because I loved it so much. And there's even an implication through into the credits of, you know, things still happening. And I would like to have seen a sequel to this. There are reasons why it probably wouldn't have worked, but
probably not, but I do kind of lament that it didn't do as well as it could have at the box office, because I definitely would have watched a sequel to this. And in a way, I think a sequel to this could have been just like sort of the sequel you talk about, how you wish Resident Evil 2 had been the sequel they promised in the last scene of Resident Evil. The last scene here sort of leaves open the idea of what could be a fantastic sequel, could be kind of along those same similar lines to what you thought a sequel to Resident Evil could have been.
And we saw how that worked out.
It worked out great for the people involved. I mean, that has been a money machine.
Someone in there? There's a beaver in the bathroom. Kill it!
Yuck. Can we please go swimming now? Ever occurred to any of you that there might be more beavers?
But it never occurred to anyone.
Well, while I recommend The Crazies 2010 extremely highly, and we'll be talking about that one probably for some time to come whenever anybody asks me what movies they should see from the more recent years, we wrap up this episode with a movie from 2014. You had seen it already, and although I had certainly heard plenty about it, I had never actually sat down and watched it, and this was the time to watch Zombievers. And I'll let you explain how this fits in thematically with everything that we went through already.
Well, Zombievers, it takes place in a small lakeside community, a sort of a rural area where everybody knows everybody and people show up who aren't from around there. Everybody takes notice. And I do think it has that same feeling in that sense. Obviously, it's a movie with a very different tone.
Yes.
And both Ravenous and The Crazies, you get the feel of having been in an entire town, at least. Like, it's a compact location, but in both cases, you kind of get the lay of the land. Ravenous takes place mostly in the woods, but The Crazies takes place across this entire farming town. So yes, location's small, but still it feels a little bit bigger. Zombievers feels very small.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place basically entirely at a single cabin, cabin in the woods.
Cabin in the woods.
But I had seen it previously in sort of just a hunt for something goofy. And thing is, when I watched it for the first time, I was expecting it to just be downright awful and like exploitative, and it wasn't.
Well, one of the things that struck me is we have our three central girls who are going up to the cabin first, it seems, to get away from their respective boyfriends and spend a weekend, but then it turns out it was really a plan by at least one or two of them to bring their boyfriends up and spend the weekend with everybody. Typical teen hijinks and sex comedy kind of stuff. One of them gets topless almost immediately. They're wearing shorts that seem like they're engineered for skeletons rather than human beings. On how they can be wearing those and not have all the blood cut off to their brain. And yet, the attitude of the movie makes it very clear that this is being done tongue-in-cheek. Like, this is a commentary on that kind of exploitation. It's not exploitation in and of itself. They're aware of what they're doing, and they're doing it as a joke.
And they're doing it well. I mean, the joke lands.
And there's so much humor and great lines of dialogue. One guy in particular who very much is deliberately playing the typical goofy comic relief character actually provides comic relief throughout the movie. And there's some weird cameos, like by singer John Mayer and comedian Bill Burr, and some of the absolute cutest animatronic zombie beavers you've ever seen.
Which are clearly animatronic.
Very much so.
But like, I would go to that ride at Disney World.
Yes. And the toxic cans of green waste that seemed like they were, like they fell off the truck from a Return of the Living Dead movie, turned the zombie beavers into animatronic silver-eyed, you know, lethal beavers. And this movie does do one of the things that most big American movies won't do. They kill a dog. And I'm impressed with that. Give him extra points for that one. Although I like the behind-the-scenes stuff. The dog just swimming around the beavers.
You find out in the post-credits, of course, dog's fine. And there's someone off-camera who's being like, he's supposed to be afraid of them. And it's just a little dog paddling around in among all these animatronic beavers. Being like, this is fun. Are you a dog? I'm a dog. So he's fine. He's fine.
And it has great action. It has absolutely, there's no point in analyzing the pathology of this because is it a zombie movie? Well, the beavers are zombies, but then their bite transforms people.
In like really weird ways.
Yes.
It's something that kind of, I think, combines a couple different horror genres together. And I love it.
It's insane. But it's insane. And that's the other thing. I mentioned at the beginning of this how all the movies we're talking about in this episode look good.
Yeah.
This movie is obviously a low budget sort of exploitation movie that's having fun with the absolute silliness of their premise. And yet it's not only funny and nicely written and fun to watch, but it's amazingly well shot.
It is professionally filmed. This was not a bunch of college friends who bought a handy cam and decided we're going to make a zombie movie in the woods. This is a professional production, and you had looked up the filming location and were really surprised.
Yeah, they shot at the Disney Ranch, which is like one of the legendary places. I think also the Golden Oak Ranch is what it's sometimes referred to. And it's one of the legendary locations on the Disney property where tons and tons of television and film have been shot over the years. It then led me to a bit of a rabbit hole because it's like, how did these people shoot at the Disney Ranch? And I'm, to be fair, if anybody out there wants to set me straight, then let me know. That's fine. I don't quite know how it works. Maybe you can rent the space at the Disney Ranch for some of this.
But you just imagine on a small budget.
Yeah, I just always assumed that that was more the purview of a larger studio to do that. Mm-hmm. But then again, we also found out that at least one of the people in this was a former Disney Channel star.
Yeah, he was, what show did we figure out? Zeke and Luther. There's some Disney Channel kids show. Yeah.
Or Dano.
Hutch Dano. There was some Disney Channel show called Zeke and Luther. So he was Zeke. So he was one of the titular characters.
He has one of my favorite lines in the movie where he's got like, he's the asshole who's like cheating on his girlfriend with another girl, both of whom are there and are friends. And there's the part where they're like, you know, hunkered down, Night of the Living Dead style. Because they also do quite some nice Night of the Living Dead homages.
Yeah.
And there's the part where he says something like, you know, like, after this, we'll take the time and try to figure out why you both are so attracted to me. He has absolutely no awareness of what's going on. This is great.
And you were noticing little, like, call-out lines of dialogue that, like, reference other movies, too.
Well, here's the thing. At one point, that same character, while boarding up the place, says something like, come up to the cabin, we'll have a few laughs. And everybody listening right now knows, probably already knows where I'm going, but that's Bruce Willis's famous ad-libbed line in Die Hard.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
And that's what led me to look up the guys who did this. This was done almost entirely by brothers Al and John Kaplan and their friend Jordan Rubin, which sounds very much like guys who probably all went to camp together for many years. Or maybe the local JCC, I don't know. The Kaplans, as it turns out, I'd already encountered, and I didn't realize that this was a movie they'd made several years ago, and we may have talked about it on early episodes of this podcast. We discovered the Kaplans had started quite a healthy run of stuff on YouTube, which you can still find, where one of them, I don't know which one, Al or John, does a pretty spectacular Arnold Schwarzenegger impression, and they started doing a series of parody videos with clips from the movies as if they were a musical version. So, for instance, they did a Conan musical of Conan singing about, you know, everything happening in the movie.
Mom, show me the wizard who killed my mother. True, I've never played to you before. Still, what would I give if you could help me see this through? And if you do not listen, then the hell with you.
For me, since Commando is one of my favorite movies of all time, they also did a musical of Commando, Jenny and Me.
You know the two of us, we're going home now, back to the mountains for Jenny and me. Wipe those tears away, cause Daddy's here now, everyone's dead, you're finally free.
We want you to start up your unit again, John.
No chance. And do you see this woman standing here? She's going to be your new mother.
And then they did Die Hard.
Mr. Rambo, it looks as though you're finally out of luck now. There'll be no more cat and mouse since Miss Gennaro is your spouse. This is the end.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Die Hard must be a particular favorite of them because they made sure they threw that in there. But it's that kind of sense of humor that's actually throughout this whole thing.
I think it's a hoot. I know there are some people who probably won't find that enjoyable. You do have to have like a certain sense of humor, I think. I'm not saying it's either right or wrong. It's just some people obviously find certain things funnier than others. And I think for us, it was just the sheer absurdity of it we found really funny. And some people might look at it and just say, that's dumb. And that's okay. But in a sense, it's sort of, if you want to watch a horror movie that is in no way really all that horrific, it's a fun thing to do.
It does have one of the most shocking and disturbing, and for men watching at least, most absolutely bone-chilling attacks by a creature on a male character in a movie that you will ever watch, and provides a nice bookend to a similar scene on the flip side from Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
I would say that one of the things I like most about this episode is how we run the range from a French-Canadian film that everyone is hailing as a breath of fresh air for the zombie genre to Zombievers.
Which is kind of a breath of fresh air, because, you know, they're out at the lake, it's very fresh, and it's something different.
And that'll do it for this episode of Doctor of the Dead. Find a complete archive of this show, along with many other podcasts, at itunes.com/G2V. Be sure to subscribe for the latest episodes, and if you like what you hear, rate and review. On Twitter, follow Arnold at Doctor of the Dead and Natalie at NB Latovsky. Doctor of the Dead is a G2V and ATV Publishing production.